2, 3. Oops. This is Eleanor Swamp, continuing the interview with Frank Gavlin in State College, Pennsylvania, on July 21st, 1998. I did have a few questions from yesterday. You referred several times to cars, and I wanted to know what kind of cars you were driving.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had a, I inherited from a family a 1937 Oldsmobile.
Ooh.
It was pretty good shape.
This was when you were in college, an undergraduate.
Yeah, well, I got it when I first went back to college. I intentionally didn't, after the war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before the war, there was no money for any cars or that kind of foolishness. But after the war, I had money to buy a car. Well, you couldn't buy a car, as a matter of fact, but I had money. But I purposely did not want an automobile because I knew I had to work. And going back to school after being off for several years is tough.
Yes, it is.
And I sweat blood being re-educated because, you know, chem, math, physics, I was back into the old books. I didn't understand any of it. Or what I had, I'd forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to Homestake in 57, I got a...
47.
I got the 1937 Oldsmobile, and I drove that until I was at Climax a while, and I started having trouble with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought a 1950 Plymouth, which turned out to be a very, very good car. I got something like 106,000 miles, and the head was never off that car.
Did you buy it new?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And
how much did you pay for it?
Way more money than I had. Gosh, I'm trying to think. Maybe $2,500 or something like that. I can't remember.
And did you make payments on it?
Yeah, I took a loan, and but I had a very short loan. I had it paid off, and
mm-hmm.
in short, probably $2,000 I paid for the $1,800, mm-hmm. $2,000 probably about what I paid for it. And I kept that car till halfway through my experience at Union Carbide.
Mm-hmm.
I made the mistake of buying a Rambler. And that was a real turkey. And then I got a Plymouth station wagon. And since I've been at State College, I've had a series of Oldsmobiles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Often for a second car, we've used a VW Rabbit and Mazda.
Mm-hmm.
Mazda.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep a car till it dies.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's how I handle the cars.
Did you do some of your own mechanical work on it?
Very little. I'm not much a mechanic in automobiles. And I quickly learned that if you're ignorant, leave well enough alone. Plus, I have another little problem. I have a slight defect in my inner ear. Mm. So if you get under and try and do things under the dashboard, I become dizzy.
Lose your balance. Mm-hmm.
So a couple of times that, and you feel lousy for a couple hours after that.
Uh-huh. Well, that was one question I had.
Is that recorded too?
Yeah, right. I mean, I don't know if anybody else is interested in it.
But anyway,
I've had, over the years,
had very good luck with those mobiles.
Uh-huh. Well, and of course,
in the family, we've had an Oldsmobile since 1930.
Well, and that's one of the few brands that's still around from those days, too.
Yeah.
Another question that I wanted to ask was about movies. You mentioned going to music things, but you haven't said anything about going to movies. Was this a part of your formative experience? As a child,
well,
or later?
When I was a kid, movies were fairly expensive. The movie theater was in the next town. And but the theater and pier used to burn tires, old tires. So kids would roll a tire 3 miles over to pier as the price of admission to get into the into the theater. And then
why did they burn tires?
I don't know. Cheap fuel. You had a big furnace and you threw the tires in.
Oh.
The theater owner was quite an old character anyway. But anyway, that's the way that was done.
So if you rolled it, if you came with a tire, you could get into the movie?
Mm-hmm.
I see.
And as you know, money was short.
Yes.
In the 40s and so, or 30s.
Mm-hmm.
So we had for a couple of years in Fort Pierre, there was a small theater that had 16mm movies, but they were grade B, triple minus and below.
Uh-huh.
A lot of kind of shoot 'em up, but Black Hat and White Hat types.
Uh-huh.
And most of the times I went, I was in college. I didn't do much for movies. The schools I went to were very demanding.
Mm-hmm.
During the week, you never would go to a movie, period.
No.
On weekends, I'd go see a movie. I guess about as many movie, when I went back to MIT, I was running scared.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't fail on this one. And I was nose to the grindstone. TV had just come in, and they had in the grad house at MIT, this would be 53 to 55, in the graduate house, they had one room that had TV set up. And on Wednesday, I would go down and hear Groucho and Dragnet. They were half-hour programmed back-to-back. And on Saturday night, I'd hear Jackie Gleason for 1 hour.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the extent of the TV.
That was it.
And the rest of the time, study, work, and I was in the lab.
What about radio as a child? Was this something in your life?
Well, you always had a radio, but again, in Central South Dakota, there was a great constraint. There was one fairly large station, WNEX, out of Yankton, which is still mm-hmm. going. Mm-hmm. This was a station that gave Lawrence Welk his start.
Right, I was going to ask about Lawrence Welk, too.
And it was kind of interesting station. Quite well done for a small community of Yankton, who was quite small, and did quite a good job. But you began seeing, for instance, the WNAX brass band, the WNAX bohemian band, the WNAX studio band were all oompa oompa oompa.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the same band. I would hear a few but often, even during high school, I spent a lot of time studying.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess Saturday and Sundays, Sunday nights with Jack Benny and you. So I guess Benny and Fred Allen, and occasionally you would hear Colonel Schwarzkopf and Gangbusters. And as a kid, it was Little Orphan Annie, The Air Adventures of Jimmy Allen,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and few like this. And the other thing I did as a kid was about 6 o'clock at night, Amos and Andy would be on for 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And Then when about 31 in there, when Bird was down to Little America, they used to flash a signal. I think it went from Little America to Buenos Aires, up into Newfoundland someplace, and then back to New York. And you'd get this thing, and they would on AM, they'd rebroadcast a short wave. And you just couldn't hear anything.
But you knew it was
but,
coming.
But you knew it was coming, and you'd get enough. Mm. And it was quite interested, and people were very fascinated by Bird's expedition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he had taken a Boy Scout with him, Paul Simple, who later became quite a well-known Earth scientist. But basically, I guess I didn't listen too much to... I wished... and then we had a local station, but the local station did mainly hospitals and played records and things. And it was about the only form of communication. During the 30s, the rural telephone system went out entirely. They couldn't afford to maintain a line, so that was all gone. Yeah, I was in a big county, but well spread. In the northern part of Stanley County, it was probably 5-10 miles between some neighbors. There weren't good roads. So a lot of the ranch families, you would see them in November, and they'd really stock up on food, and you wouldn't see them again until late March, maybe April. And so the radio did all this stuff on the hospital, and then anyone wishing to communicate, the radio was the means. There was no rural electrification. Rural electrification was a wind charger with usually a 12-volt battery that ran a radio. That was rural electrification. And so they would, the radio was their means of communication with the outside. They couldn't get back, but anyone in the hospital, anyone wanting to deliver a note, that was broadcast over the radio station. But it had no formal programming. It was just...
This was not ham radio, this was regular.
No, this was a regular station.
Commercial radio.
Station still exists, but it has more generous days these days.
Right, different.
Than it did back then. But, and one woman ran the thing.
Well.
And did the whole thing.
Key person in the community, wasn't she?
And, well, she was the means of communication to the whole rural area.
Sure.
Which was very vital. But again, that's not a station
that
you want to spend your life listening to. I kind of regret I didn't do more of it, because since I was a child, I've developed a tremendous interest in the big bands, in jazz. And I never listened hardly any of the big bands. And yet, now I've got a big collection of air checks from the big band era, but I never heard any of it.
What did you do did you have dates? Did you have dancing or?
Well, there was a little dance, but in, you know, a small town that you're kind of restricted.
Yeah.
There were quite a few dance halls during the 30s. I think there were three of them in town, but there were for an older group, kids didn't go to that.
No.
Mostly, you know, we hunted jackrabbits and hiked and played cowboys and Indians up on the hill, and Missouri River was close. We did a lot of hiking down the river, and we had some old handmade rowboats, and we were out in the river. And
what about Indians? Were there, did you know Indians? Real Indians?
Well, yeah, there were... there were Indian reservations on about 2.5 sides of Fort Pierre. To the north is the Cheyenne. To the south is the Lower Brule. And to the southeast is Crow Creek reservations.
Were these children in school with you?
Yes, but it worked out this way. The bulk of the Indians went to Indian schools. There was one in Pierre, and there was one up north. I mean, there are a number of them scattered around. quite frankly, the government education stunk. That was a lousy education they gave the poor Indians. You know, after ripping them off the land, they gave them a lousy education. So a lot of Indian families would move in to town. Shouldn't say a lot, but a...
Mm-hmm.
And also, you must realize that in central South Dakota, since the mountain men were there, well, Verandre brothers were through there in 1743, and Lewis Clark expedition went through there, and there were a lot of mountain men in there in the whole time. A good many of the Indians carried French names.
Mm-hmm.
Roubidoux, Deschucket, Lebeau, Frenier, etc., etc., etc. So that there were a lot of people that were part Indian.
Mm-hmm.
In my class, say out of about 15, there was one girl that was Indian, part Indian, but you know, probably 50, I don't know what, 50%, 25-50%, something like that. And two of the boys in class married part Indian girls. There had been a big, what should I say, a long string of important people who were Indian or part Indian. Scotty Phillips, who was very important in early day Dakota. His wife was Indian. Scotty Phillips is the person that saved the buffalo. What he did is he bought a few, the northern buffalo herd was extinct about 1885. The southern buffalo herd in the Kansas, Oklahoma area, I think was extinct about 80 or 81. So there was an old Frenchman by the name of Dupree. You may remember the town, there's a town, Dupree, South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
Well, old Louis Dupree had gotten a dozen buffalo.
Mm.
And Scotty Phillips got those buffalo from him and had a buffalo pasture. This would be 1890 in Fort Pierre. And that herd was eventually dissipated in the early 30s. But all the buffalo in Wind Cave National Park, all of those in Custer State Park, all of those in Colorado, etc., are descended from that herd. The only other source of buffalo where some buffalo came in from Canada into Montana. And that was a kind of a tragic thing because in their infinite wisdom they had rounded up the buffalo, but they mixed in the wood buffalo with the plains buffalo, so they had bred those two distinct species out of existence. But in South Dakota they all descended from Philip. And that Phillips family was very important. They were all part Indian. Related to the Phillips was a man by the name of Waldron. He went to Annapolis, World War II, beginning of World War II. He was a lieutenant commander, and he was commander of Torpedo Squadron 8. Torpedo Squadron 8 were the first ones in at the Battle of Midway. Out of 30 men, one guy survived. What they did, though, is because we were using three aircraft carriers and we were attacking the Japanese at the extreme range, and there was cloud cover, they got lost, and so when it came time to hit the Japanese, the fighters and the bombers and the torpedo planes were all separated. Torpedo squadron went in and they go in on the deck and release a torpedo. They didn't accomplish anything, didn't hit anything. Or if they did, didn't work. But what they did do is they pulled the Japanese air cover down. The Japanese air cover's up higher, they saw these Americans that came down and got them. Just then, the dive bombers broke out, U.S. dive bombers, and they ended up sinking three that day and one the next day, three Japanese aircraft carriers.
Hmm.
But only one man, Ensign Gay from Texas, got out.
Hmm.
But anyway, the commander of that was Waldron of Fort Pierce, South Dakota.
So he did not survive.
He didn't survive.
Hmm.
There was another Phillips, who also was an Annapolis graduate, who commanded a new destroyer, and the kamikazes got him. So he didn't survive either. And there was another one who was a major in the Marine Corps. So that Phillips family was something else again. The family ended up as U.S. attorneys, etc. That was a classy family.
Mm-hmm.
The sheriff of Stanley County for many years was Bill Powell, who was Indian.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of interesting, in those days Indian couldn't go into a bar and drink. That didn't come till Eisenhower's time. And so here the sheriff couldn't legally go into the bar.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a well-known man. He was a buffalo hunter. He'd done everything. Bill Powell could do anything. And then later, the district attorney, Raymond Roubidoux, was the state's attorney of Stanley County. So there was a lot of liaison with Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, in central South Dakota, the Indians are going to be bred out of existence.
Mm-hmm.
Give another 100 years. Mm-hmm. It would be difficult to do that. There were a lot of other kids in my high school that were part Indian, quite a number of families. Mm-hmm. And as I said, some Indian families would purposely move into town so the kids could go to the school and stay away from that Indian school, which wasn't much good. But even at the Indian school, I used to see over by the Indian school in Pierre, there were Indian families that would come, this is in the 30s, come live in tents. And you know how the Dakota winters were. Okay?
Yeah.
And the kids went to Indian school. Well, that was better than the alternative.
Mm-hmm.
On a personal note, I've already pointed out that my grandmother's brother and sisters had married Indian.
That was off the tape, though.
Oh, it was.
That was before we taped. You
all
hadn't
right.
mentioned your connection.
Okay. My grandmother Applin, whose name was Leno, had...
How was that spelled?
L-E-A-N-A-U-G-H.
Okay.
We originally thought it was French, and there is a lot of French in that family, but that name may be Irish. She was orphaned in Dakota Territory in early 1880s.
Wow.
Had to be evacuated out of Wounded Knee area in 1890.
Mm.
But her grandmother, she was orphaned and her siblings as well, and her grandmother brought the whole family out to Dakota Territory at that time because her grandmother's brothers were with, well, one of them was Red Cloud's interpreter. This was a Janice, J-A-N-I-S family.
Mm.
Antoine and Nicholas Janice.
Mm.
In fact, is Antoine Janice is buried next to Red Cloud. Right.
Wow.
Now, down on the Rosebud.
Hmm.
So her brothers and sisters married Indians, so that anyone with the name of Janice, Leno, which had also been Americanized to Leonard, or Iott, I-O-T-T, or sometimes I-Y-O-T-T, B-E-O, I guess, in French, are some kind of relative of mine. Then my brother's first wife was Indian, and so I have four nieces and a nephew that are Indian.
Mm-hmm.
They're enrolled members at the at Cheyenne Agency.
Mm.
One of them is a policeman in Sturgis. One is a nurse working in Colorado. One is a bank accountant in Minneapolis. One is a teacher. So they've been very successful
in
there.
Mm-hmm.
One is works for a radio station in advertising and graphic displays and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they've done quite well.
All done well. Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting.
Gone to college, you know, and mm-hmm. anyway, they've done well. But this is not atypical, particularly in Central South Dakota.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I said, you know, and some of them you couldn't tell already.
No. How was Rubidoux spelled in that area? I've seen so many spellings
He's now an attorney, or he was, maybe he's dead now. He's an attorney in Rapid. I think it's R-I-B-I-D-E-A-U, maybe X.
R-I-B?
I think it's R-I-B.
Rubidoux?
R-U?
Well, we can.
We'll
have to track that down.
I'll have to track it down.
I know there were so many different spellings of it.
And of course, a lot of those things have been anglicized.
Sure, they change it.
With my own name, I could hardly complain about that.
That's right. I know there were Rubidoux around the hills too, and they spelled it all.
I'm sure that's all the same family.
Probably, and yeah. Well, that's all very interesting. I think.
But there is all mm-hmm. kinds of connections like this.
Right.
In fact, there's one that kind of tickled me. One of my playmates was a redheaded guy. We used to go play cowboys and Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And we never let him be an Indian because he said, who ever heard of a redheaded Indian?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this guy went in the Army and married a part Indian woman in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And his daughter was redheaded, and I got out of the when I got out of the Army, I saw another classmate, and he said, "If you see Lyle, you better keep your mouth shut about that redheaded Indian."
Because they do have redheaded Indians.
Okay, I guess we've done that one.
Now, one other little question. I kept asking you what kind of clothes you wore, and you just said work clothes, but I'd like to be a little more specific. When you say, think back to Leadville, for instance, when you were working there at Climax, were you wearing, what were your pants made of? Were they denim or khaki or
usually I would wear a khaki shirt, something like that. The pants would be often khaki or slate gray, something like that.
I think this is before Levi's and denims had not become
standard. Well, the other one that became popular later too was when I got back to MIT, the Harvard uniform was khaki pants and a slate gray jacket. That was the uniform. So Harvard and MIT and so forth, that was a uniform.
That was different.
But
the denims had not come in as work clothes yet.
Well,
it was
very common for farmers and ranchers.
Farmers.
They all, my grandfather, they sold all kinds of Levi's and,
mm-hmm.
and well, there are two major manufacturers, Levi and H.D. Lee,
mm-hmm.
made most of those jeans.
But other workmen hadn't taken that on quite yet.
A lot of them use bib overalls.
Uh-huh.
A denim bib overall.
Uh-huh. But you didn't.
Uh-huh.
No. What kind of shoes did you wear?
Well, originally we just wore some kind of work shoes.
Were they boots or shoes?
No, they were up above the ankle.
Mm.
But most of them were not steel-toed yet at that time.
Mm-hmm.
The steel-toe became more popular probably in the mid-50s in there,
mm-hmm.
than steel-toe. And then by 1960, you couldn't get into an industrial operation without a steel-toed shoe.
Right.
but in the 40s it was still.
Sometimes you had them, sometimes you did. I think I had steel toed when I worked at Homestake.
What were the soles?
Just kind of a composition. It looked not unlike conveyor belting, something about like that. There was a fabric woven into, and then the thing was cast, and it had some kind of knobs on the on the sole to give you a little bit of traction.
What did you do about laundry?
Laundry? Gotta think.
There were no laundromats yet. There were no drip-dry clothes. Did you send them to a washerwoman?
I did. I must have. I had no option. Because I didn't, I certainly, when I was at School of Mines, I used to send a package home. Because you could mail a package quite cheaply. But when I was working, I'm in no way would my mother do the work clothes.
And you didn't
I talked to the landlady and said, Who does work clothes? In fact, my another thing, I'm sure that's what was done. I'm sure it was
a washwoman.
Yeah. And of course, there were a lot of them because, as at the boarding house I stayed at, there were quite a few people working at Ball Mountain underground. So there was quite a few.
Those things have all gone out.
Yeah.
No washwomen anymore.
I know. Well, of course, the when I stay in Lead in the summertime up by Terry Peak, why I come down and use that a couple of times a week. We're down with big load.
But you do it yourself at laundromat, right?
But that's godsend.
If anybody told you as a boy that you'd be doing your own washing, you probably would have hooted, wouldn't you?
Not now.
That's right. Times have changed a lot. Okay, well, those were just questions that I wanted to fill in with a bit. I guess we're ready to move on now.
Okay.
Had you pretty well finished Climax, do you think?
Oh, yeah, I've done that.
Okay.
Okay. I said after, after 15, 16 months of Climax, well, before that, actually, after about a year, I got restless. And I thought, well, maybe I ought to consider moving on. And out of the blue, I got an offer, or I got a letter from Don McGlashan, who was my professor at Butte, saying that the University of Washington is looking for an assistant professor of mineral engineering, specializing in mineral processing. So I said, well, you know, that sounds pretty good. I think I'll give them a whirl. I didn't realize it at the time, but there weren't many people that had even a master's degree in that profession in the country. So I was accepted.
And what was the date on this?
This would be September 1951.
Okay.
And I stayed till 1953.
Mm-hmm.
And the School of Mines, that's why I got an offer for fall term 1951. There had been a School of Mines at the University of Washington, and it had been folded as the college or the School of Mineral Engineering into the College of Engineering. And this
is in Seattle?
This is in Seattle. Probably about a year or two before, they had combined the School of Mines in with the College of Engineering, so it was a separate School of Mineral Engineering in the College of Engineering. And they had done that when Dean Milner Roberts, M-I-L-N-O-R, had retired. He was quite a famous mining man in the Northwest and in Alaska. And the director at this time was Drury A. Pfeiffer, P-I-F-E-R, D-R-U-R-Y. And in the School of Mineral Engineering, the Pfeiffer was director, and they had three departments of ceramic, metallurgical, and mining engineering. They had about three faculty in each, and I was assigned to the mining division. It wasn't uncommon that the mineral processors would be associated with mining departments in the eastern part of the United States, But also in the West, in Seattle, because of the strong coal influence, a lot of coal in the state of Washington. Mm-hmm. And I'll get to, there's, UW is even stronger in coal, and I'll get to that a little later. I taught everything in that area. I taught mineral processing, flotation, hydrometallurgy, industrial minerals. I did all the labs. Had to prepare all the labs myself.
Mm. Were you replacing somebody who had
I replaced H. Gordon Poole, P-O-O-L-E, who had gone to Case Western Reserve in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And so I taught all those. Plus we had a prospector's course, kind of an adult education prospector's course, which was kind of unique. I had a fairly heavy teaching load. One term I totaled it up, and I got in at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I left at 5 o'clock or after at night. And during that time, I had two free periods in the whole day, hour-long periods, two of them during the whole day. So.
Oh, sorry. I have to.
Okay.
This was your first stint at teaching then, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I at Butte I'd been a graduate assistant, so I did had to do all the labs in processing at Butte. And both jobs, it was kind of interesting because many of the students were about my age. At 27, I was the youngest assistant professor in the College of Engineering at the University of Washington. Well, in those days, you didn't get promoted very rapidly.
No.
So often you'd be 45 before you became an associate professor. So, a little different than today.
Yeah.
The Pfeiffer had an interesting experience. He graduated from UW in the early 30s, and he found a job in South Africa, and he stayed in South Africa working in the diamond and...
Sorry, Frank.
Okay.
I won't disturb you.
And the gold mines until after World War II. Kind of an interesting sidelight. A few years ago, I saw a review of a book called Innocence in Africa, and it said the author, Innocence in Africa.
In Africa. Mm-hmm.
It was published by Harcourt Brace in 1994, and the author was Drury A. Pfeiffer, and I said, huh? And so I got the book, and I went to the back page on the slipcover, it had his picture. And it was certainly Drury's son, all right, because he looked almost like his father. I had actually met the son a couple of times. His father, he had started as a student in liberal arts at UW during the period I was there, and his father had introduced me to him on a couple of occasions. But it's a fascinating book on being an expatriate in South Africa in that period.
I actually read that.
Huh?
I have read
you
it.
You did.
Mm-hmm. Very
well,
good.
Well, for the record, the interesting part was, of course, that young Drury Pfeiffer and his sister were born down there, so he didn't remember much of this, but his mother was a prolific writer and wrote letters home to his grandmother, and he got a hold of all of those letters from the grandmother and was able to put this whole thing together. I can recommend the book. It's very well written. He has a tremendous command of the English language. But I would like to get a hold of him and talk to him. He wasn't cognizant of the mining industry or its history. Mm-hmm. You know, he acted like, well, his father had to go to South Africa because for a job, and that wasn't too good down there. But it wasn't good for anyone. He wasn't cognizant, really, of the depression in the States either,
no.
So he didn't understand. But it's still a very good book and a fascinating book. And interestingly enough, many of the people I was with as students and at UW in the period wrote me and said, "Are you familiar with this book?"
Uh-huh.
They had all picked it up too.
Mm-hmm.
But the name, Drury A. Pfeiffer, was so unique.
Yes.
The school itself had a good faculty. Pfeiffer was a mining engineer, taught mining. They had Joe Daniels, who handled, he was an MIT graduate from, 1910 or something. He handled coal preparation, the only coal preparation course taught in the western part of the United States. So I was able to refurbish coal credentials years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he taught iron and steel production. Jack Finley was a Houghton graduate, and he handled non-ferrous metallurgy. Mel Peckett, P-E-C-H-E-T, didn't pronounce it in the French manner, did geology, he was Harvard. Jim Muller out of Ohio State and University of Missouri, Rolla, was ceramic engineering. I audited Daniel's coal prep course and Muller's crystal chemistry course. Both of them were excellent courses, and they were very good teachers. Also in the same building was the U.S. Bureau of Mines Northwest Experiment Station, which was one of their principal coal preparation research stations. In those days, the Bureau of Mines stations were on university campuses, on the
mm-hmm.
University of Minnesota campus, on the campus at Berkeley. The thermodynamic station was there at Berkeley in the Hearst Mining Building, at Oregon State and Albany. The Bureau of Mines was there, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, around the country. And the coal station was at University of Washington, in the same building. I was just they had a large process bay area, and they'd slung a mezzanine in there and put some offices. So I was a half floor above the bureau offices, and so I got to know Dr. H.F. Yancey and Max Geer, G-E-E-R, very well. Those names are classic in coal preparation literature. I had long talks with them, and they were a big help. I learned a lot about coal. And one of the very fascinating things is during World War II, they had sent these experts over to Europe to find the state of the technology, and in the state of the technology in coal preparation was the bailiwick of Dr. Yancey. And he saw this hydrocyclone that had been developed by Driessen, D-R-E-I-S-S-E-N, in Holland. And he brought back that hydrocyclone, and it quickly became very important in coal. And by the time I got to Climax, it was starting to come into the ore industry. And today, no door rake classifiers, no Aikens spiral classifiers. Essentially, 99% of the classification is done by hydrocyclones.
Mm-hmm.
They're small and cheap. Not quite as efficient as the others, but a lot cheaper and take up essentially no floor space. Yancey and Geer were doing research in coal jigging and heavy media processes, in suspension stability, on process analysis, online instrumentation, etc. And so just by talking to them, I picked up all of this information. And of course, I walked through their pilot operation almost every day, so I knew pretty well what was going on. There was an interesting cooperative program they had there. They had a cooperative fellowship program between the university and the Bureau of Mines. And they were in the same building. And under the co-op program, the Bureau of Mines gave a student a fellowship and a little stipend. Hmm. And of course, get a waiver of tuition. And he did his academic work in the school. He did his research work in the Bureau and ended up with a master's degree. So it was a nice cooperative program.
How was it administered then? The Bureau was in charge of the...
of research. Mm-hmm. And the Geer and Yancey were adjunct faculty.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and certified to be thesis directors and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very... and of course, when there was thesis defense, they showed up for the thesis defense.
Mm-hmm.
As well, it's a fact.
Was this special there at Washington, or was this
no? A number of schools
standard.
Did that.
Mm-hmm.
And in my era, there were two students like this: Farlow Davis, who had graduated from South Dakota School of Mines, and has just retired from San Manuel. Mm. U.K. Custard, C-U-S-T-R-E-D. Was a University of Kentucky graduate, and he did most of his professional work in the Florida phosphate fields. But going way back, going back into the 30s, was a man by the name of Julian Parton, who had graduated here at Penn State, P-A-R-T-O-N. And he later then came back east, did some of the very early work in coal flotation, and ended up as CEO of Lehigh Navigation Coal Company, the largest anthracite producer. After me came Al Durbach, D-U-E-R-B-R-O-U-C-K, who got his bachelor's from Idaho, and Stan Jacobson, who was a UW bachelor's. And they were in that cooperative program, and they spent their professional life mostly with the Bureau of Mines and the U.S. Department of Interior, or Department of Energy. And Durbach was the highest ranking coal prep engineer in the government when he retired.
Mm.
Also going back into the 30s were some well-known people in the preparation. One was Oscar Tangle. T-A-N-G-E-L.
I've heard that name a lot.
He ended up at Battelle. There was Rush Spedden, who went to Montana School of Mines under Godin, and then followed Godin back to MIT. He was on the faculty at MIT. Then
what was the Spedden?
S-P-E-D-D-E-N. Then he was director of research for Union Carbide Ore Company and director of research for the Kennecott Lab in Salt Lake City.
Mm.
He was my boss for quite a number of years. And F.T. Davis, Casey Davis, who ended up with Colorado School of Mines Research Institute. And my paths would cross all of theirs later on professionally. So it's kind of, you know, again, I keep saying it on and on, what goes around comes around.
Uh-huh.
I had another learning experience, and that is there was a very famous chemist in the chemistry department by the name of Tartar, T-A-R-T-A-R. And his specialty was in micelles, and surface active agents, i.e. detergents.
Micelles?
M-I-C-E-L-L-E-S.
Okay.
Just put down detergents, that's good. And they had a large colloid symposium, and I went over and got to see all the big shots in colloid chemistry at that time.
Mm.
One other kind of interesting aspect, there was a lot of, they had a lot of ore samples around from Kennecott, Alaska, and really some real neat ore samples. And they also had some old equipment. And down in the basement, I was down one time rummaging around, and they were doing some cleanup, and they said, "What is this?" And I looked down, and it was a pilot-sized McQuestion tube. The McQuestion tube was Frank McQuestion's father's invention. It was a cylinder, long cylinder, usually on nearly a flat angle, 2 to 5 degrees, and you pumped ground ore into it with reagents, and the reagents would usually be oils. Actually, they were vegetable oils, so they were really fatty acids. Hmm. And they would attach to the sulfide minerals and it would float to the surface. And as they rotated this material, they had it at a flat angle, so they had a very, very a large surface area inside mm-hmm. the tube. And so they would feed the material way back into the tube, and then they would take an overflow out of the sulfides that had floated across the top. And as it revolved, it kept dumping them out. Mm-hmm. And so it was one of the early, probably 1905, something like that. It was one of the early day flotation processes.
Yeah.
It was so early that it predated most. The first flotation plant in the United States was 1911, mm-hmm. Timber Butte Mill in Butte. And so this was before that.
Well,
another good learning experience were field trips. The Tacoma smelter, one of the principal arsenic smelters in the United States, was at Tacoma. They could handle high arsenic ores, and one of the principal sources of the high arsenic ores was the Philippines. So this Tacoma smelter was tidewater, so there were always ore boats from overseas in with concentrates. Bethlehem Pacific had a open hearth operation, so steel making plants. There are a lot of brick plants in the area. And then I was in charge of the senior field trip. So we went over and saw Kaiser Aluminum in Spokane. We went up to the Knob Hill gold mine in Republic, Washington, a very interesting mine. One of our UW's graduates by the name of Andy Fergus, F-E-R-G-U-S, was on the staff there, and he recently retired from the Bureau of Mines in Albany, Oregon. They had a fascinating thing, first time I'd ever seen it. They had a door tray thickener, and they were using that for a countercurrent decantation, i.e. gold, separate the dissolved gold in the cyanide solution from the ore, which is now impoverished in gold. And then we went up into Canada to Consolidated Mining and Smelting. Their mine and mill was at Sullivan, BC, and that was fascinating because they had a 12-foot, 1,000-horsepower, fast-running rod mill. It was probably the first one, if not the first, a second. 1,000-horsepower was massive. Today, we've got multiple 6,000-horsepower motors, so we've got mills with 12 and 15,000-horsepower. But in those days, there was no air clutch or fluid coupling, so they had to build the starting torque into the motor, and they couldn't do it economically. Mm-hmm. So about 1,000 was about as big as they could go economically. Mm. So I got to see that new operation. They had a heavy media operation in which they scalped off about 20-25% of the gang and threw it away. So in essence, at core size, so it came out of the crusher, they took a fraction out, ran it to heavy medium, threw a lot of stuff away. So in essence, they increased their tonnage by 20% by a simple expedient. And then they found a small amount of tin in the ore, and so they take the flotation tailings from lead and zinc flotation, and they went to a series of tilting frames and recovered the cassiterite, and then they had their own smelter there, so they produced tin.
Mm-hmm.
And I had had this interest. I pointed out that I'd had this tin experience at Washington, mm-hmm. and also when I was at UW, they were doing work on some material from Good News Bay in Alaska, and there was tin in that operation. They dredged it for a while. It was not economically, but they did recover gold and tin from the thing. The town of Seattle, a couple of weeks after I got there, it started drizzling. Mm-hmm. And Seattle, it drizzles from late September to March. And by March, I was ready to cut out paper dolls. I had a fascinating job which kept me fully occupied, but if I hadn't had that job, I'd have gone, had to climb the walls.
Yeah,
so this drizzle, not heavy, but just continual.
Mm-hmm.
They get about the same rainfall as Boston, but in Boston, the heavens open up and down it comes.
Mm-hmm.
That's a month worth of drizzle in Seattle.
Uh-huh.
But come spring, the Seattle area probably has the most beautiful springs in the world. You've got blue skies, big fluffy cumulus clouds, snow-covered Olympics outboard, they have snow-covered cascades inboard, Mount Rainier sitting up there 14,000 feet, and they were doing a lot of raising of bulbs. So down near a town south of Seattle called Puyallup, P-U-Y-A-L-L-U-P, was the daffodil capital, and these daffodils had come out, and there's acres of them. Then you would see acres of red tulips, acres of yellow tulips, etc. And, you know, here's Mount Rainier. I didn't have a camera in those days, but, you know, it's too bad because it was just a joy to be alive. And then they had very good, you know, a lot of good rhododendron and a lot of good flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And, but to get to those good flowers, so I kind of disliked my first winter in Seattle, but after that, I enjoyed Seattle very much. Let's see.
Where did you live?
I lived close to the university. First time just off the university, next time a couple of miles away. Mm-hmm. And I had almost a straight shot. First place I could walk to the university, and second place I had almost a straight shot. They had good football team, they had good basketball team. It was very interesting. There were, at that time, there were about 12,000 students. Now I think there's 40, but there were about 12,000 in my era. Mm-hmm. And it was a good experience. That summer, I was accepted at MIT as a grad student. I was getting kind of, I would get probably antsy getting.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, I didn't feel I knew enough. And I had concluded that there were two schools that I could go to. One would be Utah, and the other one would be MIT. And I'd always kind of wanted to go to MIT, so I thought I'd do this. And Joe Daniels was in charge of the undergraduate kind of recruit evaluation for MIT. MIT in those days, I guess still do, in every major community around the country has a group of their former graduates who will interview potential candidates. Mm-hmm. And Daniel performed that function, and he wrote me some very good letters. And then Doug Firstenow, who in the meantime, when Doug left Butte and I went to Climax, he went back to MIT as a grad student. So he was back there. And so anyway, I decided to go to MIT. During the summer, I went back to Climax, and I've already talked about that. And then at the end, so it'd be early September, I left and drove back to Boston. Via Penn State, where I stopped off to see Dave Mitchell. Dave Mitchell was a well-known coal preparation man, and he had been a consultant, not on coal, but on some of the other things, for Climax. And so I'd met him at Climax, so I stopped back here. And then I said, well, would you fix me up to see a coal prep plant? And he said, yes, I'll call Julian Parton. Well, again, what goes around comes around.
Yeah.
And so I went over to see Julian Parton, and so this was at the Mahoney, Mahoney, City, Pennsylvania, in the anthracite region. Mm-hmm. So I saw that plant, and then I went up to Boston. Before I go further, I'll have to read the MIT.
Fall of 53? Yeah.
So this is September of 53.
So you were at Washington for two school years.
You
were at Washington
at UW for 2 years, 51-53.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me spend just a few minutes here.
Sure. Right. Okay.
This is the MIT segment. I was there from September of 1953 to May of 1957. MIT had a fairly good liaison with both South Dakota School of Mines and Montana School of Mines. And I guess both of those schools in the period 1942 or 38 to 1965 had put maybe a dozen students into MIT, a lot of them in mineral engineering, but not all of them. So there was a good connection there, and I'll talk a little more about that later. In mineral engineering, we had 12 or 15 students. The section was headed by A.M. Antoine Mark Godin, who was called Tony, but we never called him Tony to his face. In those days, the students and the faculty were two different things. And of course, I had a interesting experience. I'd come from a faculty and now I was a grad student, and that's quite a humbling experience. There were four faculty in the mineral engineering. There was Tony Godin. He was doing radio tracing, thickening, and he was doing the second edition of his flotation book. There was Phil DeBrain, who was doing surface thermodynamics.
How do you spell DeBrain?
Small D-E, capital B-R-U-Y-N. He came from South Africa originally. There was Dick Charles, R.J. Charles, who did comminution and scale-up of grinding devices, and Doug Firstenow. The latter three were assistant profs. Doug did hemi micelles, electrostatic attraction of collectors and of slimes to very fine particles to mineral surfaces, ion exchange, activation, bubble flow. Doug was an interesting fellow. Ideas seemed to flow like sparks from an anvil from Doug.
Sparks from a what?
Anvil. I had known him since 1946, so he used me as a sounding board often. And he had a few ideas not so good, but he had about the highest recovery of good ideas of anyone I've ever known. Mm-hmm. And so I knew a genesis when these things had been done. He received, for example, the Godin Award for his work on the electrostatic theory of flotation. Well, I saw that at Genesis. Mm-hmm. A lot of other people had also done work on it, but I knew who did it first, by far. It was also interesting to kind of get inside the creative mind. A lot of us, you know, we make 3 yards of carry, and often we won't make the first down, and then you got to start over again. Doug was very creative, and he had a lot of things, and all of these things I talked about turned out to be winners as published papers and of important work. My thesis, let me stop and go into another thing. I was a research assistant. I was paid quite well, but the MIT had a high tuition. They took most of it back for tuition. And in those days, today, students get a waiver on tuition for the tax. We didn't. We paid both state and local tax on the whole schmear. So, it was a continual money cash flow problem. Uh-huh. And while I had a stash of money, it turned out I didn't have enough. There was a lot of thrilling research going on. Couldn't possibly begin to tell you all the things that were going on, a lot of it. Well, you can imagine with 15 people or something, there were a lot of things going on. Mm-hmm.
Let me just ask, if I may interrupt, what was the physical setups? I'm trying to get at how you were interacting with each other.
Okay. MIT, if you stood in front of it, they had two big wings and a big center section, and they added on stuff in the back, and they've added more and more and more. But in those days, most of MIT was all hooked together. You could walk down a corridor and come to the next department, and each department was in a part of that building. We were in Building 8. So metallurgy had from the basement to the third floor in Building 8. Mm-hmm. And mineral engineering was on the first and second floor. And so all we had to do was walk downstairs and we could see all the rest of the group.
Mm-hmm. So
we were at this end, one segment of the building.
It was easy to run into each other, mm-hmm, and exchange.
And the faculty
ideas.
Was just across, their offices were just across the hall or down the corridor or down on the next floor. So everything was fairly close in. And there were a lot of good liaisons. I made many good friends from that era.